Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, we'll speak with our Jerusalem correspondent about the U.S. Defense Secretary's visit to Israel. Consider the long road to go for normalizing U.S.-Cuban relations. A look at the value of encryption in the cyber world.
Encryption allows you to take your data, your photos, your emails, all your electronic communication, and kind of lock it up.
And hear about a rapper who finds himself in financial and legal trouble. It's coming up right here on The Voice of America. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter is in Israel on the first leg of a trip to meet with allies in the region. VOA Jerusalem correspondent Scott Bobb joins us on the line. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you.
Say, what can you tell us about this trip?
Well, it's the first trip by a cabinet-level official U.S. to Israel or to the Middle East since the Iran deal was announced almost a week ago. Clearly, it's meant to try to rebuild some frayed edges in the relationship between the United States and Israel, and to reassure the Israelis, and also to see how they can proceed to ensure that Israel is secure.
Well, the U.S. and Israel have long time been friends, and close friends at that. But Israel has come out strongly against this new Iran nuclear deal.
Not only strongly, but repeatedly. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has just taken every opportunity, every photo op with a visiting dignitary, every appearance locally or internationally to denounce this deal as a bad deal, and lately of historic proportions that paves the way for Iran to acquire nuclear weapons, and also by easing sanctions gives it billions of dollars of more funds to engage in terrorism. So he's very strong, and he's continuing that, and it seems that he is trying to build up support in the United States, both public and especially in the U.S. Congress, which, of course, is to review and approve this deal.
Also on the Secretary's agenda is the ongoing fight against the Islamic State. Do we know how Israel stands on that?
Well, Israel is obviously very concerned, but is sort of staying publicly out of the fray as much as possible because it has reportedly some very backdoor, very almost secret connections with some of the more moderate Arab states about mutual security worries and how to address them. By coming out publicly and forcefully, it is feared that this obliges some of the allies on this issue for the moment, let's say, might have to publicly disavow, and some indeed have. So Israel does try to stay under the radar, but it is very concerned, especially about activity along its northern border with Lebanon and Syria, and to a lesser degree, but still nevertheless significant degree, with Egypt.
Well, thank you very much, Scott, for speaking with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
For more on how the U.S. Defense Chief's visit to Israel is playing out on social media, Michael Lippin is here in the studio. Michael, what have you seen so far?
Hey, Susan. Well, you know, if you look at the latest tweets from the U.S. Defense Department and the Israeli Defense Minister, the language is all very positive. To get U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter's perspective, there are actually two Twitter accounts to follow. One is his department's main handle, at DEPT of Defense, that's Department of Defense. The other is his spokesman Peter Cook's handle, at Pentagon PressSec, that's PressSec. Now, Cook posted a brief video clip of Carter speaking at a joint appearance with Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Ya'alon, and this is what Carter said. Israel is a cornerstone of the U.S. strategy in the Middle East, and its security and qualitative military edge are a top priority for America, our military, and for me personally. As we were just hearing from Scott Bobb, U.S. officials are emphasizing their security commitments to Israel because of the Jewish state's concerns about the nuclear deal that Washington and other world powers reached last week with Israel's main regional enemy, Iran.
How did the Israeli defense chief respond to Carter's comments?
Well, Ya'alon was full of praise for the U.S., actually. If you want to find him on Twitter, his handle contains his nickname, at Bogie Ya'alon. That's spelled BOGIE_YAALON. Now, Ya'alon posted a couple of tweets in Hebrew in the past few hours saying things like, Israel has no greater friend than the United States of America, Relations between the defense establishments of the U.S. and Israel have reached unprecedented heights. And even at this time, the U.S. and Israel are continuing joint projects in high technology, training, and cooperation. Now, those kinds of comments are typical from Israeli leaders who rarely criticize U.S. officials publicly and personally. Even though the Israelis have expressed strong displeasure about President Obama's nuclear deal, but, you know, that criticism is continuing. All you have to do is look at the Twitter account of Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, who continues to talk about how world powers should have done a better deal with Iran. Susan?
Okay, well, thank you very much, Michael. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Professional astronomers, with help from amateur stargazers, have discovered a fascinating binary star system some 730 light years away from us in the Draco constellation. This two-star system contains a very hot and dense white dwarf that is actually devouring its larger companion star by stealing its gas. The scientists say that the white dwarf's mass is so dense that a teaspoon of material from it would weigh as much as an elephant. Another factor that sets this star system apart from others is that it contains a large amount of helium but no hydrogen, which is very strange since hydrogen is the most common element in the universe. The University of Cambridge-led team made their findings by analyzing data gathered in 2014 by the European Space Agency's Gaia satellite, along with additional observations made by a collective of amateur and professional astronomers. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Today marks the historic restoring of U.S.-Cuban relations, but there is much to do to unravel more than a half century of restrictions, as International Edition's Jeffrey Young found out today. Hey, Jeff, thanks for joining me here in the studio.
Hi, Susan. I spoke with Thomas Bilbao. He's the executive director of the Cuba Study Group in Washington. Bilbao says that both the executive branch and Capitol Hill have a lot of laws and regulations to change to reflect the new relationship between the United States and Cuba.
We do, but opening embassies puts us in a position to advance U.S. natural interests on the ground in Cuba. It allows our diplomats to have greater contact with civil society on the ground and with diplomatic missions there, and to work with Cuba on a number of bilateral issues that are of mutual interest, like drug interdiction, oil spill mitigation, and terrorist financing.
Tell me about the work that's going to have to be done on Capitol Hill.
Well, while we opened embassies, we know that the embargo is still in place, and that's because that was codified by Congress, and it takes Congress in order to do away with those sanctions. For example, Americans' ability to travel to Cuba for tourism is something that's explicitly prohibited in law. However, there is legislation to do away with that travel those travel restrictions, and there are other legislation in place to expand telecommunications, to wholesale lift the embargo, or to expand trade in different areas. So it will take Congress moving to do away with those sanctions.
You know, for decades, big developers, they've been looking at Cuba and they've had big eyes and a big appetite. All they see is Condo Canyon. All they see is development. How long do you think it's going to take?
I think that what we should concentrate on doing now is helping Cubans start, operate, and grow their businesses and let them be the authors of their future. And I think the United States and the U.S. business can play an important role, but I think that the future of Cuba should be led by the Cuban people, not by us.
What about laws that have to do with property, with investment, with protecting people's development? Every country has to have laws to protect investments. Are Cuba's laws on the books, presently on the books, strong enough to encourage investment and development, or do they need to be beefed up so that Cuba becomes a more attractive place for outside money?
Well, we've already seen that there are foreign investors in Cuba, and Cuba, in fact, redid its foreign investment law last year to try to attract new businesses, and it did attract some, but I think that a lot of companies still have very legitimate concerns, including the ability to hire and manage their own staff, to be able to pay their staff directly, a number of labor concerns, and concerns regarding property and the protection of intellectual property and other things that really will have to be resolved if Cuba hopes to attract the type of foreign investment that it needs to grow its economy to be able to be competitive in the 21st century.
That was Thomas Bilbao, executive director of the Cuba Study Group in Washington.
Thanks, Jeffrey, for that report.
Glad to be of help.
The restoring of full U.S.-Cuban relations has some business owners biting at the bit. Joining us on the line is reporter Alexis Christophorus in New York. Hi, Alexis.
Hi, Susan. Thank you. That's right. From internet service providers to U.S. banks, an array of industries stand to benefit from free trade and travel between the U.S. and Cuba. But companies involved in tourism really could be among the biggest winners. We're talking about American cruise lines that will stop in Havana and airlines such as Delta and American Airlines, which has long had a major operation in Miami. Also, telecommunications companies will now be able to create infrastructure in Cuba that will open up a communication pipeline between that country and the U.S. It's reported that only about 5% of Cubans have access to the open internet. And, of course, U.S. farmers see a big opportunity here. Cubans apparently crave Louisiana agriculture products, especially the Bayou State's rice. And officials say Louisiana is perfectly positioned to cash in on trade with Cuba because of its close proximity to Louisiana ports. Louisiana can get rice to Cuba cheaper than just about anybody else, so that would translate to a premium for Louisiana farmers. And, of course, American car companies are eager to make inroads in Cuba. Ford and General Motors tremendous opportunities there. And Cuba could even be a destination for a car company that wants to assemble vehicles from kits, essentially crates of parts that are shipped to a factory simply to be put together. So the possibilities appear to be endless, Susan.
Well, thank you, Alexis, for that business update from New York.
You bet.
Coming up on International Edition, safety steps in the cyber world, and a rapper finds himself in hot water on two fronts. For over a year now, the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, James Comey, has been on a campaign warning against the dangers of computer encryption. He is pushing congressional leaders and Silicon Valley executives to build in such secret safeguards as what are called backdoors and key escrows that would give agencies like the FBI emergency access to data critical for stopping crime and protecting national security. But now a group of cybersecurity researchers and cryptographers is pushing back, arguing such measures could make the entire internet more vulnerable to hacking attacks. International Edition's Doug Bernard follows cyber issues, and he spoke with VOA's Pete Heinlein about the encryption debate.
Think of encryption as sort of like a lock. Encryption allows you to take your data, your photos, your emails, all your electronic communication, and kind of lock it up such that anybody who doesn't have that lock won't be able to get access to it. It'll just be electronic gibberish. So it's a great way to protect your information from prying eyes. Now, one of the reasons, the principal reasons, I think Director Comey is so concerned about encryption is because he says, look, as so much of our lives are kept on mobile devices now, that data very often can be useful in helping stop crime or even, you know, protect the national security. But with encryption, without those keys to get inside it, the mobile phones and computers, as he calls, as he says it, become safes that you can never unlock.
What's a backdoor?
So if we're thinking of encryption as something like a lock, think about your data as being kept in perhaps a house. Your house has front door, back door, maybe windows, whatnot. These are all ways that bad guys potentially can break into your house and steal your stuff. So in an electronic form, these are basically pathways that bad guys can use to get in and steal your data and, you know, muck about with your things. So as much as your front door is the main point of access, a back door is actually a secret path that a software engineer builds into a program, and perhaps only they and perhaps maybe the government only knows ideally about that back door. A key escrow, think of it as like giving a key to a neighbor. That neighbor becomes, they end up holding a bunch of keys to all their neighbor's house so that if something happens and somebody needs to get in, they're a trusted person, they can take that key that you've given them and get into it.
Okay, so we hear what Director Comey is saying. What are the cryptographers saying?
When you think about, you know, protecting your house and locks and doors and that sort of thing, it does really kind of make good sense. But what cryptographers are saying is, look, you know, encryption and cryptography are really much more complicated than these metaphors and analogies that we use. So what they're saying is that any point of access into a system creates a vulnerability. So the least vulnerable house in the world is one that has no doors, no windows, and no way to get in or out. But that's not very useful. So they like to keep entry points as few as possible by building in back doors, perhaps, or key escrows where the encryption keys are held. What they're saying is fundamentally you are building insecurity not only into that encrypted system, but really into the internet as a whole. And so if you push for these things, you're just going to make the internet less secure, increase the number of hacking attacks, and put more of your private data at risk.
Well, I'm just one little guy. Why should I care?
It's one thing to think, you know, I don't really have anything to hide. You hear that a lot. You know, I'm just me. You know, I don't really worry about it. I think almost universally is that people may say that up until the point that their data is hacked. People may say, I feel secure in my house. I don't really worry about crime, up until the point that somebody breaks in and steals things. And then so often you hear those individuals saying, I feel fundamentally violated. I don't feel safe anymore. And I think the same is true electronically. If you may feel safe and comfortable online, but up until that moment that someone steals your identity or steals your data or starts putting out false things about you on the internet, then you start feeling very vulnerable and you really understand the value, I think, of encryption.
Thanks, Doug and Pete. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Rapper 50 Cent has declared bankruptcy after a court ruled he had to pay $5 million to a New York woman for releasing a sex tape without her permission. International Edition's David Byrd and Ray McDonald talked about the multimillionaire's case, which will go ahead despite his insolvency.
When your album is Get Rich or Die Trying, and you actually do get rich and don't die, to declare bankruptcy might seem a little strange. Ray, what is this with 50 Cent saying he's bankrupt or filing for Chapter 11 protection?
It was all a strategic maneuver, Dave. On July 13th, 50 Cent filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy just a few days after losing a lawsuit. He was ordered to pay a $5 million compensatory judgment after a woman sued him over a sex tape he posted featuring her a few years back.
Now, this woman is rapper Rick Ross's ex-girlfriend.
That's exactly right, and 50 is beefing with Rick Ross. So.
And so this is kind of like, okay, I'm going to shame you in public. And
jab you.
Okay, but the court ruled in the woman's favor that she was actually defamed or libeled, or not libeled, I guess that's print, but she was defamed by this videotape.
This is correct. Now, back in May, Forbes magazine estimated 50 Cent's net worth to be $155 million. I think it's important to note that the man is not out of money. In fact, he's making light of this entire situation. He posted an online photo of himself standing next to a tiny little smart car, saying, yeah, things are tough out here.
My money on my mind, got a meal out the deal, and I'm still in the grind. That shorty says she's feeling my style. gas, I'm feeling my flow. A girl from Woody, they buy and they ready to go. I'm bottle full of blood, mama, I got what you need. You need to feel the blood.
Well, now he wears Armani suits and Jimmy Choo shoes. He has like a Rolex on his arm.
He's doing promotion for his latest movie, Southpaw.
Right. And he also sold his vitamin water interest for $100 million. Now, he did have to pay out another judgment when somebody sued his headphone manufacturing company for copyright infringement or trademark infringement or something?
This is correct. And 50 makes the point that when you are successful, he says, I have a bullseye on my back. I'm an easy target. But this lawsuit has not played itself out yet. The $5 million judgment, as I said, is for compensatory damages. Punitive damages are still to be determined.
So he could be forced to pay this. I thought when you go into Chapter 11, that protects you from your creditors, so all these judgments against you and anybody you owe money to just disappear.
In a Chapter 11 bankruptcy, proof of insolvency is not required to file. It's more a reorganization of whatever assets you do have. How much does 50 have? At this point, we don't know, but we may find out.
All right. Now, if you want to send Ray a tweet, he is RayOnTheHits at Twitter.com. You can also hit him up on at VOA underscore music. And, of course, you can send us a tweet here at International Edition. We are at VOA underscore IE. And if you want to hit me up, I'm at David underscore DBird. And that's BYRD on Twitter.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at VOA underline IE. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Iraqi government has announced it is leading a major military push to retake Iraq's Anbar province from ISIL, which controls two of the province's major cities, Ramadi and Fallujah. Clearing ISIL from Anbar is no easy task. As President Barack Obama recently noted, ISIL has dug in among innocent civilian populations in the urban areas under its control. But as local forces take on ISIL militarily, it is also important for ISIL sympathizers in Iraq, Syria, and beyond to hear the stories of those who were once attracted to the propaganda promulgated by ISIL, but who have come to reject it. As President Obama has said, to ultimately defeat terrorist groups like ISIL, it is necessary to discredit their ideology, the twisted thinking that draws vulnerable people into their ranks. Who can do that better than those who have seen it from the inside at close quarters? Take, for example, a former ISIL fighter from Fallujah known as Hamza, who volunteered to join ISIL last summer, but who defected after 6 months. He told the Independent newspaper he joined the group for religious reasons, but was appalled by the beheadings, by being asked to execute Sunnis whom he knew, and by being offered captured young Yazidi women for sexual pleasure. At the beginning, I thought they were fighting for Allah, but later I discovered they were far from the principles of Islam, he said. The justice they were calling for when they first arrived in Fallujah turned out to be only words. Or the Syrian teenager Youssef Barho, recruited by ISIL to be a suicide bomber, who eventually gave himself up to Iraqi authorities. He told the New York Times last year he joined ISIL willingly because he believed in Islam and had been convinced by ISIL that if he didn't join the group, Shiites would come and rape his mother. Soon, however, he said, I noticed things that were different from Islam. He noted, for example, that ISIL inflicted severe punishments on men in the city who were caught smoking cigarettes. Yet in camp, he saw fighters smoking. He witnessed homosexual encounters between the fighters, and he became increasingly disturbed by the killing of innocent people. President Obama has said that the international fight against ISIL is a battle against terrorists who distort Islam and whose victims are mostly Muslims. Those who have experienced ISIL firsthand and have turned away say the same.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.